He was being so beaten and being so abused in the house that he used to hide under the house, and it became the safer place in his home of origin.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM. Today, I will be having a conversation with media personality Liz Gunn. She has just come from filming homeless people and will no doubt have something to say about this. It is an important topic, especially just before an election, as we need to look at how our country got into such a mess and what's going to be done about it. I see on social media much distress about the poverty in New Zealand and anger and frustration about the state of our rivers and lakes. There are passionate people who want to change cannabis laws, 1080 drops, fluoride in our water, and the threat of mandatory vaccination. Others are concerned about corruption and war. And what were our troops really up to in Afghanistan? And was 9/11 really set up in order to give the US a people's mandate to invade there and many other places besides? Perhaps we learned too much via the internet to allow us peace of mind. But one thing we can be sure of, the media do not give us the whole story, and therein lies one of the biggest underlying problems of our day. Welcome, Liz. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. What an interesting list of issues you raise. And I think in some ways it's very empowering to know that we can nowadays get our sources of news, of views, of ideas, of research, all sorts of things from the internet. But it's also a little bit overwhelming for people. I think, do you sometimes feel that, Lisa? You can look on the Facebook stream, and I have a lot of political posts on mine, and I think, I can't deal with the amount that needs to be changed in the world right now. And other days I feel really powerful and proactive, and I'm going to get out there and do something to make a little change in my corner of the world. Do you feel that too?
Most definitely. I find that I feel a bit like I'm a person who looks at the big picture. So I'm looking at all the things that are wrong. And then some of my other friends are looking at the individual things, and I think that's an easier journey than my journey, but my journey is definitely bigger picture.
I see that too. I love to learn, so I love to research, so I love to go into lots of different avenues of ways in which we can make a better world, because I think so many of us want to contribute before we die. We're here for a short time. We flame up like a beautiful little candle, and then the candle will die back down, and we'll be gone. So what is our contribution here? It's certainly not about the money we make or the buildings we live in or the vehicles we drive in. I've often said this. It's about how we just add something to make a better world for our children. Women often feel this very strongly, don't we? That we want to leave a better world for our children.
Yes, and we both have children, and I have grandchildren, and I'm thinking, what on earth have we left to them? I mean, surely we should be stewards of the land, and we should also be ensuring that everything is going to be as good for our children and grandchildren as it was for us growing up. And in fact, it's a total and utter mess.
It does seem as if the baby boomers were given so much as youngsters, and have, in a way, the generation's been so scarred by looking from the outside, certainly, like a generation that's taken when they were young and now continues to take. And I don't quite understand that. I know the millennials, who are friends of mine, the young ones, already are really waking up to wanting to make a different, a kinder, a more connected world. We had an incredible experience of this when we were filming homeless on the streets of Auckland on Queen Street. Beautiful, in some ways almost a Buddha-like figure. He had this this internal calm, yet his story is horrific. His name's Don, and he's been on the streets for 30 years. Oh. In 1987, he first went out. He was 8 years old. And when we asked about his story, it's quite hard to talk about this, to even think this has gone on while we're all living our comfortable lives. He was being so beaten and being so abused in the house that he used to hide under the house, and it became the safer place in his home of origin. He was fed there like a dog. He was given no love. So he said to us on Queen Street, "So it was safer for me out here on the streets at 8 years old." And he's been trying to make a go of his life ever since and climb back out of that. And if you look, you can see his story on our Facebook page. It's called Ask Why, which is one of the biggest things with Facebook. You can read things and you can ask why. It's something JFK said. Ask why. Ask what I can do for the world. So we were filming Don and had the microphone on him. And this was my cameraman, wonderful Australian guy who's contributing so much, who's come over and has been capturing stories that are really powerful. Anyway, while he was filming, this gorgeous young group of young Argentinian schoolchildren came up, led by one very articulate girl, and it's very moving to see the connection she quite quickly makes with him. Interview. They want to interview. They want to find out Don's story, and it's all being filmed by Conan. And in that corridor, just the saddest disconnections in society that you can ever imagine in a country of 4.5 million become evident. You know, the disconnections of our welfare system punishing him. He has had jobs, obviously, in those 30 years on and off. But if his employer was late with his monies and he couldn't report to Wins on the monies he was getting, then Wins punished him for being late. But it was the employer's fault that he was compromised. So then he stood down for 6 months with zero income, yes. You know, or for 2 years with zero income. These punishing, this punitive welfare system that we have has to change. So this is something you can actually get out in your own communities and start to talk to the people you see suffering and make differences within our communities.
Well, I was actually I have a parking ticket for $15 which I forgot to pay. So the next thing I get, only one notice, the next thing, and this was in Wellington, not Auckland, the next thing I get a $45 bill from the Justice Department. And it says, if I don't pay, $102 will be added to it. So just imagine anybody that perhaps didn't get their first parking ticket for $15. How are they going to, if they're on the benefit or a very, very low income, how are they going to pay that $45? And then to add $102 on the top, they're going to be in debt. They're going to be in trouble with the law. It's like, you know, it goes on. And these amounts where people are put in debt for something really silly at the beginning is going to really impact hugely on somebody's life.
Hugely. There was many examples of this punitive system, but there was a Tongan woman who's struggling with six children and a solo mother and working two jobs, one of which is as an all-night nurse. So she's qualified, incredibly giving, hard-working. And she had a rather materia moment where there was an infraction in 2005. She did not realize that they were breaking the law because of a separation with her husband. And her husband had been unwell, and out of concern for him, she continued to sort of have the children there, but to feed the children. And there was some to-ing and fro-ing between houses. But she said, I truly did not realize it was breaking the law. So when she went into the IRD, when she was told she was going to be fined or punished for this, there was a fine for this, she said to me, just looking with the most genuine confusion in her eyes, she said to me, why would they not believe me when I told them the truth? And she said, here I am still supporting my husband, trying to help him through because he's not well. Instead, what's happened is, on that original fine, which he couldn't afford to pay, has been added interest. And so the next time there is punishment for her non-payment, the next lot of interest is on the original fine plus the IRD's interest. So it becomes compounding, if you see what I mean. Each fine period has added to it interest from the IRD, and the next fine period is in fact more, because the amount, the original amount, now looks larger. And her solution was, couldn't they just have asked me to pay back over time the original amount they wanted? I would have worked really hard to do that. And now she's saying, the only way I can deal with this debt is if I die, is death. If I die, they can't come after me, but it's too much for me to pay. It would be way beyond what she'd earn in a year. And this is a ridiculous way to run a society. People who are feeling so hopeless and so overwhelmed, they're still trying to bring up good, ethical children. They're still trying to do the right thing by their wider family. She is just so depressed and disheartened by it. I'm in awe that she can go still and do two jobs and look after her children, but she does. But she was clearly not fully understanding the system, very much overwhelmed and feeling utterly alone. And I don't think we want that in New Zealand.
No, I think we have a really nasty, nasty system and a nasty streak in some New Zealanders too. I mean, you mentioned Materia and her story, and I was on the DPB for 16 months at the same time as she was on, and it wasn't enough to live on. I can say that categorically. I was able to teach one day a week, which brought in an extra $80 for me. I think it's absolutely appalling that people are not given enough to live off and then penalised if they try and find some other way to get enough. I mean, imagine if the person let the child starve. What would society be saying about them then? So they don't let the child starve, and then they get all the judgment. And
I heard in a political debate last week one candidate calling it witch hunt welfare, because it does have an element of that cruelty. You're right too about some of the people who are very well healed who judge these beneficiaries and think that they're ne'er-do-wells. I haven't met any who don't want to get off the handout and off the hand up and be independent. All of them say to me, I want to have my own life. I want to work. I want to be able to provide for my children. But for many of them, the inconsistency of not having a home, often moved on every 2 years, changing schools, trying to find new places to live where they can afford to live, often in garages. The uncertainty and the inconsistency, I couldn't live like that and be productive. I couldn't. The pressure of it would stop me sleeping and stop me being able to do productive things out there in the world with confidence. And many of them say, if I could just get a home to live in and stabilize my family, then I can start to contribute. You can see how quickly they would get out and give back to society. But we have to give to these people, because they're just like a little sister or a little brother. They need a hand up.
And there's the whole issue of transport, because our public transport system is really inadequate. And so if these people have cars, and then you can't pay for the warrant or the registration, and then you get caught with that, then you're fined again. The whole system compounds. So you've got to, if you're on the dole, I believe, you have to apply for a certain number of jobs each week. And if you do that, you can only apply to jobs that you're going to be able to get to from a transport perspective. And it just seems to me impossibly difficult.
Impossibly difficult. And I think many of the people who are feeling the sharp edge of this punitive welfare system don't have English as their first language. So all of the form filling feels enormous. One man, Rion, whom we spoke to on the street, said, you know, I have to go to report to WINS if I'm looking for any help, but I get so paralysed with fear before I go there that I'm often late for my appointment or I miss it. But if I miss an appointment, I'm punished more.
Yes.
So the lack of human compassion is extraordinary. And speaking of you being on a benefit, two of the women I talked to this morning who are out at the Monte Cecilia House out in Mangere, and it's being run wonderfully there with great compassion, and we're going to be posting something on Ask Why about that in the next few weeks. two of them were saying that when they're in these ghastly garages, cold and damp and drafty and leaking, often with some of them with up to 20 in one house, some with 9 in a garage. I mean, it is just ghastly to think of this. But they were saying they would, and I didn't realize this system goes on, but they said many of the Samoans who come here to work in factories, to be productive members needed in our factories because other Kiwis don't want those jobs, many of them, they can't get housing help for the first 2 years of being here. It's a government policy and it needs to change. But they said many of them prepay their electricity because the payments they receive from the government are so low, they dare not keep going to debt each week. All of them, I interviewed 8 this morning, said that it's paid on the Monday. Generally, by about Thursday, they're starting to run out. So it lasts them about 4 days, being really tight with money on food. This is for food for the children, some school costs. Because remember, we also have education costs being put on these people too.
Yes.
So things like phones and power and heating, they have to go. So I said to them, so what happens if you prepay your power and you've run out of the $20 you've put on your power bill, you've used that power in a cold snap, and you don't have the money, what do you do for the last 3 days until the benefit is paid again the next week? And they said, we live in the dark, and we just have to manage with blankets or try to dress up in as many layers as we can. And I said, you mean you don't even have candles? It's just horrific to think of that happening in New Zealand, and yet I've seen posts on more, shall we say, right-wing blogs, but I don't see left and right. I just see humanitarian or non-humanitarian on those who are finger-pointing and judging and not being humane and thinking there, but for the grace of God go I. On the less humanitarian posts, I see people going, oh, we don't have poverty in New Zealand. We have dire poverty.
Yes.
In vast tracts of this country now, dire poverty. And someone has to stand up and call it what it is.
John Campbell was doing so, but of course he then was moved on. And so really going back to the media, when we have had a lot of the media telling us that beneficiaries are, well, a lot of beneficiary bashing really, telling us that beneficiaries are deliberately having lots of children in order to stay on the benefit, and all of this rubbish, quite honestly, it is rubbish. So it makes it difficult for, you know, the person just who accepts the mainstream media as it is, to get the proper story.
Absolutely. And what I've noticed coming back from those 10 years in Australia, you know, Australia's a very conservative government, actually, and in some ways very authoritarian. And I thought, oh, I can't wait to get back to New Zealand where we have at least, you know, all aspects discussed in our media. And I found a really disappointing trend in mainstream media, definitely towards touting one view. And a lot of people know that people like Patrick Gower and Mike Hosking, that they have right-wing views.
And Duncan Garner.
Yes, Duncan Garner. They don't really pretend otherwise. I mean, ZB is just full of right-wing harsh commentators pushing those really harsh ways of thinking. And, I mean, on one level, I feel deeply sorry for them. I felt sorry for Mike when I worked next to him on Breakfast years ago. I didn't see a man who had a deep inner happiness or he may have an external happiness and his life looks perfect and he's got a perfect wife and all the story he tells. But I don't believe any human being who's part of a society of human beings can be deeply happy where they say, I just have to look after me and my family, my immediate family. I'm an island here, and you're completely responsible for yourself. I don't see that leading to any deep inner happiness. You know, the Dalai Lama put it well once. He said, there's one path to being truly happy on this earth. There's only one, and that is to give to others. And it's so logical. You know, I wouldn't be thrilled on my deathbed to say, well, I've got this perfect little inner world that I have and I never cared about anybody out there. I know that in my dying moments I think I got something wrong. We are a society and we're social beings. And we're not meant to have bought into this neoliberal idea that came up in the 80s from Margaret Thatcher and her, you know, her henchmen and Reagan. And it's been carried through, unfortunately, on both left and right in a way. It's subverted everything, this idea that Thatcher said, which is there's no such thing as society. It was simply not true. And it's somehow got traction because there is a vein of selfishness in human beings. And if that's magnified and it gets hold, then it becomes justified. But equally, there's a vein of magnificence in human beings. And the magnificence comes out, you know, when we see someone having a car accident and we stop our car and we go and help them. Or, you know, when I said at the beginning of this interview, if you want to wander down Queen Street with some delicious food in your bag and some nice water, and instead of just handing it out and walking past, you get down in front and you say, "Hello, my name's Liz, what's your name?" And you say, "Look, I brought you something warm to eat." And it's just a little bit of something you're doing in one corner of the world. Or, "I've brought you a lovely pair of gloves." God, the number of people I've given lovely gloves to, and that you'd think you'd given them, you know, the ultimate present. And they often say, you know, "My hands get so cold at night, I'm so happy to have these." Simple, simple things. And you start to talk to these people and you realize they are exactly like me. But living out here, add in some trauma and some depression and some, you know, that we all have greater or lesser degree dysfunctional aspects to us as well. But they're often funny, they're intelligent, they're very kind, they're caring. One of them told me, "You know, we don't make the mess on the streets. It's the drunks on a Friday night who are really violent and drop rubbish, and we often go around early Saturday and clean them up, but the police will come and blame us." You know, they look out for each other. One gorgeous one who sits outside, Jackson, sits outside New World at the bottom of College Hill, and he said, "Oh, I found a place where I could get free food in the mornings, all these buns," and he said, I'd get them and I'd give them to all the old people on the streets. I said, "Really, Jackson?" He said, "Yeah, they couldn't walk like I could, so I had to look out for them."
Yes. And
that's really something.
Yes.
That's a rich man.
Yes.
Not someone who's harsh and judgmental and condemning. These are good human beings, and they've suffered enormously, and the best humans often have. Have you found that, Lisa?
I think that suffering is part of the human condition, and if we've learnt from it not to be bitter, then yes, definitely. I think maybe this planet is a planet to come to for suffering, but it's also a planet to come to express compassion. And you mentioned the Dalai Lama, because he talks about it all the time. And I can't see really how anybody compassionate could not understand how it is for the poor in New Zealand. And I had a conversation with a couple of ladies the other day who were very against Materia's actions and said how dishonest it was and everything. And I said, "Well, okay, put yourself in her position. Do you think she should not have tried to get a law degree?" And they said, "Oh, well, it's good she was trying to get herself out of her situation." And I said, and if she didn't have enough money to feed herself and her daughter, then what should she have done?" And so one said nothing, and the other one said, "Well, I would have done it, but I'd have told social welfare later and paid it back." I said, "As soon as you tell social welfare, you're in trouble. You can't do that, because you've basically taken a loan without asking permission. You can't do that." So then I think they realised the situation.
Because of this punitive system we have that doesn't make allowance for human lives. Mm. It's black and it's white. And it's good or it's bad, but there's a grey area where Materia is a really fine woman. When I've spoken to her, she's intelligent, she's deeply caring, she really wants to contribute something much greater to a better New Zealand society. And she had the courage to admit that she made a mistake. And she did do it in her way, thinking, I interviewed her about this and she said, I've been trying for 15 years to get a media focus on poverty in this country. And I'll talk to them and I'll send them emails and I'll send them long tracts that I write about it. But none of it cuts through. But the minute they could criticize her and make it a story, an ad hominem story about her and her faults, and make it a judgmental thing that sells headlines, then the story became centre stage. But she made a miscalculation. She thought that there might be a bit of that, but they would move on to the story. There was all of that ad hominem attack and very little interest in these now mainstream media pundits, largely right-wing, very little interest in what she was trying to highlight. And I think with that story of Don that I began with on the streets, you know, he says at the very beginning of that clip, what do you do when the system fails you, when every system fails you? Yes. And this is what many of them feel. There's no way out. And now, unfortunately, because of the way the mainstream, largely male right-wing media pundits dealt with it, there's even less willingness for people to speak up about the suffering that's going on. And that's to all our costs. That's to all our detriment. That's children growing up in privation. That's children who'll do meth. That's children who'll have depression. That's children who'll do suicide. Huge suicide rates out today. What were you reading today? You mentioned just before you came to air.
Just before you came in, something on Radio New Zealand had come out about we have the largest suicide rate ever in New Zealand, and it's very large between the ages of 20 and 24. In other words, our young people are not seeing
hope
at all, and also huge numbers of Maori.
It is heartbreaking.
And it is heartbreaking, and I think that something has to be done about it. I do think that our teachers and the medical profession need to speak out more, to be honest, because they're at the forefront. They see all of this happening before it happens. And to my mind, it's not okay for them to sit back and be politically correct. I think that we need some whistleblowers, more whistleblowers than we have, because they see it.
I would agree with that, but even if they blow the whistle, will that be picked up by a mainstream media with a bias? And I think many Kiwis are realising this. I was saying about coming back from Australia, and I looked at our media and thought, where's the balance? Campbell was one voice of balance. Radio New Zealand to a certain extent, but they also were being hamstrung by the freezing by the government of any funding for 8 years. Now, that's sending a message. Don't you step out of line too far, or you won't even have a show of getting funding. So that all of the last sort of decade, it seems to me, in New Zealand, there's been this silencing of one spectrum, one part of the spectrum, and that's very bad for a democracy, that we start to then have mouthpieces, acolytes like Hosking saying in his Mike's Minute every day, just spouting government propaganda.
Yes.
And then you start to think, how far are we from communist China or communist Stalinist Russia? That's what they did on the media, and we used to laugh at them, thinking, oh, those poor guys in Russia, they never get the other side. But how far removed are we from that? Luckily, we've got Facebook. Luckily, we've got channels like this. But it's the little maverick parts of the media spectrum that are telling more truths. Or if we go hunting for it on our Facebook feeds. But it's not being done in mainstream media, this wide corridor. I mean, I'd love to sit and debate with someone from the far right and be able to have a program where we could have all sorts of views put across, and the intelligence of the audience is recognised, and their ability to decide where they come on those spectrums. But if you just have someone day in, day out, like on ZB, there's some guy at 5 o'clock, I don't know him, Larry someone, and he's just so right wing. If I ever hear him in the car, he's so sneering about people who are suffering, and it's so sad to hear that. It's not good for a balanced debate to have that sort of commentator without the balance on the other side, which says, wait a minute, we're all human. Any of us could be in their position. Let's stop and find the compassion that we used to have in New Zealand and a more egalitarian world. It's not just about get your act together. If you're not together, then you're hopeless. It's much more about, and I wonder what life circumstances have thrown up for you, and they could one day throw up for me, where you haven't been able to get yourself up out of that dip that you're in.
Well, my mother used to tell me about how it was during the war, because she was billeted out of London to the countryside. And she said that what happened was, as people were billeted to be away from children, away from home, away from where there was bombing, and into the country, the parents would go down and see the families and find that maybe these families only had bread and cheese for dinner, you know, and maybe the kids were wrapped in newspaper at night to keep them warm and things like that. And realised that the difference, the financial extremes, and...
Do you mean the ones from the country would go to London?
No, I mean just the richer people would go, yes. Where poorer people had taken their children in.
Yes.
And so that kind of made a move which caused at the end of the war for a Labour government to get into power and to correct a lot of things that were not right. So it took a war to show these things. And I sincerely hope it doesn't here. I sincerely hope that the changes can come about through really, I suppose how I'd view it is like a collective consciousness shift. And a lot of the sort of new age people say, oh, well, you know, we don't have to work on anything external. We just have to work on the internal of making ourselves better people. And I say, yeah, okay, what about compassion? We need to do stuff outside, you know, beyond our front gate. And, but really, we need a consciousness shift so that people say, hey, we can't continue being judgmental anymore. And until that happens, it's going to be an uphill battle. But maybe, just thinking about the next election, maybe enough people can have the compassion to realise that we can't carry on with the sort of government that we've got now.
I think that's right, that this absolute adherence to the economy is the only thing that matters. Even when Jacinda Ardern was put in as Labour leader, Mike did a Mike's Minute because it was posted on my page. I'm not an avid follower, but occasionally I see what he's doing. And he was saying, oh, it's just about the economy. It's not about poverty. It is a talk about poverty now. It is a talk about homelessness. Any New Zealand worth their salt who walks down Queen Street will be tripping over homeless people sleeping out there. And I don't believe Kiwis are hard-hearted and anything but compassionate, actually, by and large. But there are a few who are preaching policies that are not going to serve a country of 4.5 million people. What affects that person lying on Queen Street affects me. I am no better. The greatest among us is no better than the quality of life of the least among us. It's true in a society like this. The great divide shows up so much more in a New Zealand than, say, in an America with all its millions of people. And I think a country of 4.5 million can turn it around. But you're right, Lisa, the people almost need to lead the politicians and say, enough, you're just not doing the right thing. We don't want neoliberalism anymore. We don't want every person for themselves. Let's get back to a place where there is more sharing. I liken it to the metaphor of, if I was a teacher and I walked into a classroom and there were two children with all but two sheets of paper and all but two pencils, and the rest, so in a class of 30, two have most of the resource, and the 28 children are sharing two pencils and two sheets of paper, what would I do as a teacher? I'd say, come on, kids, this doesn't work. Yes. How is this going to benefit you two with everything? You don't even need to use this. You're never going to use up all that paper. And all your compatriots here in the classroom have almost nothing. And you're not going to be comfortable watching all that ultimately. It's not going to serve you. Plus, they're going to be angry with you and try and steal from you ultimately. You've set that up by taking too much. So what we're going to do is we're going to share it a little bit more fairly around the classroom. You guys can have a little bit of extra paper because you were cunning enough to get that or clever enough to get it or whatever term you use. You can have a few extra pencils. But come on, give back to some of these others who need a hand up. It's going to make a much nicer atmosphere in this classroom. So society is the classroom. We are that society, and the selfish little kids at school, we all knew them and we all felt sorry for them in the end. It doesn't serve any of us to just try and amass a whole lot. I love the idea that Indigenous people have, you know, that we are here for a very short time on earth. I once read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and the opening paragraph says, there's a profound difference between the East and the West. In the East, from the day that children are born, this is the old East before it became materialistic. In the East, children were brought up with the idea that you are on your way on a journey towards death. In the West, there's a denial of death. And this was written by a man who'd had to escape Tibet in the late 50s, so he'd lived half his life in Tibet and half his life in the West, and he can compare with authority. And he said, though that difference explains all of the problems that I see in the West. So if you know you're on a journey towards death from the day you're born, there is a salutary humility that comes with that. Because why would you try and take out a whole forest and get all the money from taking over as many companies as you possibly can and throwing as many people out on the dole as you possibly can so you can get more money? Why would you do that? You would know, this is a waste of my life. I'm not even going to be able to enjoy all these riches I'm amassing. Actually, why don't I keep these people in jobs and help a few more people while I'm here and maybe only take a few of the trees and make sure I replant them and I leave the world just without me having scarred it, but me having contributed something to it. So when we know we're only here for a temporary time, we contribute. When we are trying to deny that we die, we keep being voracious consumers. It's almost a way of pushing, I think there's often in people an underlying fear of dying, and a way to push that away subconsciously is to consume and feel I'm more powerful and I've taken over another business and I've got a bigger house. Somehow that's a way of death denial.
But I think we've been actually educated to become consumers, whereas I suppose in my day, being a little bit older, I was educated to be a citizen.
And explain that, Lisa. That's a really interesting difference, yeah.
A citizen really is somebody who's part of a community, who's about making things work and cooperating, whereas a consumer is about me, 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 and take, 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 and it's this individualistic idea. So I this is my how I've seen things. I've seen us, over my life, I've seen us move from that citizen to consumer and consuming. And I feel that's very, very sad, and we need to move back. And I don't know quite what will make us move back, really. But
so just developing that. So in a way, it's the same idea. As a citizen rather than a consumer, you take only what you need,
yes,
and it's incumbent on you to contribute. It's the same idea, isn't it? That you are part of a larger group. There's a bigger picture.
Yes, and it's stewardship of the land and of the people, really.
And it has a humility to it.
Yes, yes. I was educated and brought up to be like that, not to buy, buy, buy. Mm. And I'm grateful for that. But I mean, I feel at the heart of, well, one of the things at the heart of our problems is the banking system. And we really, in New Zealand, as you've said, we've got 4.5 million. We could stand up and we could change how we do things around the banking system. And the political party, the Democrats for Social Credit, understand that, and they're registered. I mean, I represent the Awareness Party, but we haven't got our 500 paid members, so we're not registered. We're saying the same things, though. We're saying that we need to have the Reserve Bank to create money. They don't have to charge interest on it. They could have rebuilt Christchurch without any interest. They could print the money for that. You wouldn't still be having people in Christchurch having terrible problems. So there's a lot of ways that we need to really look at what is wrong with our society. Why is it going wrong?
I agree.
There's
with
a material
you.
Side of things, which is the which is the banking, really, and then there's the way we have been taught to think.
Explain that.
Was what I was meaning about the citizen,
the consumerism,
to become the consumer and individualistic, and it's all about me and I deserve this.
And within that way we've been taught to think, I remember even before the GST, people saying to me in Sydney, oh, you're silly if you don't use the money you have access to, so it's very good to take loans out. Now, that makes no sense economically, but that was part of that prevailing viewpoint that borrowing money is fine. My father he married later, and he was in the war, and when he came back from the war, he had me very late in his life. He was adamant, having experienced the 1929 crash, because he was a young boy then, he was adamant you didn't borrow money. And when you think about it, it's a very sensible way to run your budgets, because anybody I've talked to from these groups of homeless that I've been speaking to, it's generally loans that have got them in terrible trouble with the compounding interest that they then owe on the monies borrowed. So a whole system where we don't have loans. I think it's Niue, who's one of the few countries in the world that's paid back all its loans, and it says it's never going to borrow again. It's Niue, or it was one of the islands that I read about 6 months ago, and I thought, wouldn't that be a smart way for New Zealand to go? Let's pay back what we owe and spend only what we can afford. It would be so good to get these interest rates down.
Well, I mean, it's the smart way for people anyway, because I figured that one out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've really had no major loans at all, just my mortgage.
How did you, with your business, Lisa, Lisa's Hummus, which was such a successful business, you've now sold, but how did you begin that without getting into any kind of debt?
I just had to work.
And you managed to do it without borrowing money?
Yes, until we needed to change premises, and then I borrowed $36,000 against the house, and I paid it back in 3 months. So that's all I ever borrowed. And that's why it was a successful business, because that's how businesses get into trouble. They borrow.
Wow.
It's crazy. I mean, it's how families get into trouble. I pay my credit card off every month, and I only have a credit card because it's kind of convenience, not because I want to borrow anything. And I brought up the kids to be the same, and then they came to university, and the first thing that was done was they were given a credit card with $1,000 on it so that they would immediately then start using debt. And I was so cross, you know.
And did they, what did you say to them? Use the credit card, but use it wisely. It's got to be paid back at the end of each month, and that's final.
I don't think that they did that. They did use it well, but they've learnt since. They're a little bit older now. Yes, I think credit cards are a nightmare.
And I know Noam Chomsky is big on this whole thing of the power of the banks in the world. It has been extraordinary that banks that were just, they were like little, really little village groups that would get together and just gently help people in a very personal way. And they've become these monolithic institutions, enormous money. I mean, the power and influence and also money of the CEOs of banks is just incredible. Money paid to them.
Well, the whole Rothschild story, of course, and you know, they're in control, really, in a lot, and Rockefellers and the others that really majorly in control of the entire world. So it is money and the banks and power that's causing all the wars and everything else like that. So, I mean, we have to be a bit cynical. But I'm just thinking about, you know, improving New Zealand, you know, just in a practical sense, to get rid of our debt. I mean, our debt was very low when the national government came into power. And admittedly, they had the financial crash. But since then, they've just been borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. Because what did we have? We had a banker for a prime minister.
I have the same feeling that I had coming into the election when, in 84, wasn't it, when Muldoon was out and Longy came in. And that ominous period where Longy was on television, I think with Ian Fraser being interviewed, and the days when we had good long-form current affairs programs. God, I wish we had those still, that were educative and informative. And I remember Longy saying, well, I've opened up the coffers and we are in dire straits as a country. We are, you know, none of this was fully revealed. I don't think we even know the full extent of what we could be up for if a new government comes in and really opens up the books and looks at what the sort of hawking of New Zealand. And it's just a testament to how you can't get past the allegory of the emperor's new clothes. You know, you have these mainstream media acolytes, and here I get back to Hosking again. For years when I first came back from Aussie, I'd hear him go, this is a rock star economy, it's a rock star economy, it's a rock star economy. But it wasn't what I was seeing. It wasn't what I was experiencing. It wasn't in great economic shape. But it's simply a piece of propaganda repeated enough, and then people start to say it to each other, and then the talkback hosts repeat it, and most of the people fall in line, and then there are these wonderful media mavericks who say, wait a minute, that's not the truth. Dita De Boni springs to mind here. She's terrific.
I've met her, yes.
Yeah, she's a really good journalist, and there are a few, you know, who I really admire. I think Nikki Hager is just so important. He's sort of the Pilger, John Pilger equivalent for New Zealand. Fearless and incredibly accurate, yes. Very intelligent, and will not be crushed, even though, again, the media, like with Materia, you know, the media attack him like attack dogs and don't look at the issues he's trying to raise. They just attack him.
Yes.
But if you want to be educated about any of these things, look deeper online at your Rothschild story, the stories you said in your introduction. You know, if you put a post up on Facebook about question marks about 9/11, you will get the attack dogs who come in and say, it's all rubbish. Or if you question, could any of the vaccines not be safe? Is there something still with this science that needs to be further investigated? Which is a valid, intelligent question for a democracy. Absolutely. Never agree with anybody who tells you that the information is final, everything's settled. I say to my kids, it's like the koru, it's like the fern opening. Information is always coming to light. There's always more to learn. That's why it's so humbling. That saying that an intelligent person is the person who knows that the more they know, the more they realize there is to know, and therefore they're innately humble. Einstein was actually quite a humble man because he knew only a fraction of what there is to know in this universe. But someone who says it's all settled and it's final, be deeply suspicious and go and investigate online for yourself.
Yes. Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, science is an unfolding story, isn't it? And so anyone who tries to tell me that, oh, well, science says this, that or the other. And I said, yes, they said cigarette smoking was fine. They said thalidomide was fine. You know, let's just wait. Well, wait and see. The only thing that I do say about don't wait and see is genetic engineering, because we just can't let it out into the environment. And so, you know, there's a lot of things. And people say, oh, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. And that's a wonderful way of shutting people down, which we need to remove, because I think we should replace conspiracy theorist with open-mindedness.
Yes, exactly. And a questioning mind, which yes. is an intelligent mind. I think the other way is to not bother about doing anything about those who liberally spray round these sorts of labels. As you say, they're meant to be intimidating. They're meant to shut down. They're meant to make for self-doubt in the sensitive, intelligent being who is asking questions. And the only way that I've learnt to overcome that sensitivity is to be true to who I am and say, well, no, it doesn't make sense to just comply here. I do need to keep asking questions. And so my choice is, do I react to this name caller? Or do I ignore the name caller and feel sorry for them? It's really not worth it. Or try to, perhaps, I always ask for respect on the thread discussions on my Facebook page. Try to, with respect and dignity, say to them, well, I have a different perspective and I may not agree with your view or you with mine, but in a democracy, I'll absolutely defend your right to have it, and I hope that you'll offer me the same respect. So we each have a right to have our different views, and it's much better if we can just discuss things rather than name call. So the minute someone calls me any name on anything, they sort of lose massive credibility with me, because I think, is that the most intelligent thing you can say? You can't deal with the issue. You just have to try to make it deal with the person, you know, ad hominem attack. It always shows you lack substance in your argument. So I sort of feel sad that they're doing that.
Yes, it is lack of substance in the argument. It reminds me of something I was going to say a few minutes ago when we were talking about the banking, and somebody put on there about what a wonderful economy that we have in New Zealand. And so my comment to them was, well, you know, ask a homeless person what they think of the fantastic economy, because, you know, that's where we're making such a mess of it. And we're allowing money to be the center. It's what we worship now, because there's not much spirituality, because people got fed up with religion. It's time that people really stood up. Everyone stands up, not just vents on Facebook, but really stands up. And so I get a bit disappointed when I hear about people not voting. Because I feel that it is a responsibility that we have to vote. And I still haven't decided who I'm going to vote for. But I'll have to, before I walk in and make a vote, I will have to do something, even though I don't see anybody with all the answers yet.
I'm with you on that. I'm absolutely with you on that. I'm praying that Jacinda, I think her heart may very well be genuine and in the right place, and that she does want a better New Zealand. But she has to be realistic going to this job, that there'll be backroom boys who will be giving her advice. And I think she has to really work out what her deep inner values are. If she does, you know, become the Prime Minister, what are her values, and to be able to withstand that manipulation. So I was watching talking of Nikki Hager, an interesting online doco to look up is The Hollow Men, and it's all about how, have you seen it?
I've got the book.
Yeah, it's really, I'd read that book, but I hadn't, now that I've lived this last period of New Zealand history, it has so much more resonance to it. So it's really a story about how Don Brash became the puppet, in a way, of people who were wanting to create a sort of Trumpian world in New Zealand of divide and rule, and this horrible racism that that gave him a temporary spike in the coming up to an election and in the polls. And you can see they're filming him when the news announces that he's had this spike in the popularity polls. And I was just staggered at how much that meant to him, something so utterly ephemeral, something so fickle. It's like the old adage of in the biblical idea of building your house on sand instead of something solid. And it was all done from sort of hubris and how can I get my name and my policy there. Nothing really of any conviction, nothing that's going to build a harmonious society, something so destructive to try to downgrade the place of Māori. When I lived in Australia with the white population who never acknowledged Aboriginals, this magnificent Indigenous population that knew so much about its and their environment and had such connections spiritually to their lands. And I never heard one Aboriginal word, and I remember thinking about year eight, oh, I'm so glad I come from a country where we've had a powerful Indigenous peoples who had the ability to stand up to the bullying of the early invaders and say, no, we are your equal and we will allow you here, but it's going to be on the basis of a signed agreement. And even though many attempts have been made to crush this out of them, they have stood their ground and they are asserting those rights. And predominantly, I think Kiwis respect them. You can see it in the haka before the All Black Games. There's a great national love for some of those traditions. But that does impact in terms of our views of Māori as a powerful people too, that haka. There is a respect there. And yet we have this Hollow Men documentary that is really showing how ghastly the backroom boys are. Getting back to what I was saying to you, an Australian group called Crosby Texter, again, not memorable, but they were hired by Stephen Joyce well before John Key came into power. And they are, you have to give it to them in this documentary. It shows how clever, how Machiavellian, how I would say cunning, how manipulative they could be. They know exactly what they're doing behind the scenes, but as the documentary unfolds, you see the herding of a population, the manipulating of messages to the population. There's one email that's quoted in there where Brash actually says to his backroom boys, well, I'm quite willing to lie, but, you know, I just want to know that it's going to get me ahead in the polls. It's horrifying stuff. It's horrifying, horrifying stuff.
He should have been gone by lunchtime.
But you have to say, and he was pretty much, but you have to say, you have to ask the question when you watch that, has this same pattern been going on in the last 9 years under Key and under English? Oh. Has there been this complete disdain for the electorate, complete disdain for honourable, hardworking, decent Kiwis who want honourable, hardworking, decent leaders? Has there been this disdain and this almost chortling behind hands saying, we can tell them anything we want, if we can get away with it, let's give it a go?
Well,
because if that is the truth, mm-hmm. and that's what shows up in the Hollow Men documentary, then we really have to look at who we vote for, and we must vote this election.
Well, Nikki Hager's book, Dirty Politics, explains all of that.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, it's been going on in politics from time immemorial. And, of course, the British series, Yes Minister, So that's the Sir Humphreys, you know, that are quietly working everything in the background, you know.
How it's all spun. It doesn't matter whether it's the truth or not, as long as it sounds okay.
Yes.
And we can get away with it.
And I think that politicians, when they get into... I think a lot of politicians are actually really genuine when they go into politics. I really do, and I miss a lot, actually. But once they get there, it's very difficult to get past all of that. And I imagine, to be honest, that that's what Trump is facing in the White House, because he went in with his certain agenda, and he can't necessarily do that agenda. You know, I mean, one of the things was he said, no, we'll pull out of Afghanistan. And now there's more troops going to Afghanistan because he couldn't do what he wanted.
Trump's such an odd one, isn't he? I mean, he's a sort of inverted gift to the world, because we can see on display a man full of lies and contradictions, a pragmatist, a man willing to go along with whatever suits him, whatever plumps up his image, even as his image is completely shattered around the world. He's sort of out of touch with that. I read a piece last week online that said there's a little team in the White House whose only job is to find positive news stories on radio, television and in the papers to take to him each morning to plump up this very... I see him as a very fragile little boy underneath all that bombast, because he's very bombastic. He's very... But he's so incredibly compromised even coming in there. I mean, that whole thing as far as the way he talked about women in that bus, you know, the whole... Yes. Lack of a deep value system, a deep ethical value system about how to treat human beings, how to treat women, the question marks over all the lies. It's also on display with him that in a way it's this inverse gift to the world, I think, Lisa, because it's making people go, oh, we can't leave it up to, inverted commas, leaders. It's up to us to be the leaders. It's up to us to speak out. It's up to us to take action. And I think, getting back to something we were talking about earlier, the people have to lead the politicians now, because they're being shown up as so gravely inadequate in so many areas and so many countries. So we have to get together as people and say, what are the values we really care about? And let's insist these are coming through. This is in a book by a young guy who's only 26, who won a 7-year scholarship to study at Oxford, fully funded. And his name is Max Harris, and he's just put out a book. If you want to read a really interesting book based on many of his conversations with leading New Zealand thinkers, his name is Max Harris, and the book is called The New Zealand Project. And it's worth reading, because he says every single part of government needs to be underpinned by, in his view, four policies, four values that will cover a more ethical kind of policy making and leadership for this country. And the four values are care and community and creativity and love. Is a really profoundly different one. And I questioned him on that. Isn't that sort of anti-intellectual? Isn't it a bit soft? And he said, no, to be able to base things on love takes an enormous strength, because you have to really commit to something that is about things much bigger than self-service and self-promotion. It's seeing a much bigger picture, and to be able to stick to that through all of the slings and arrows that are thrown at you, it really takes courage.
Well, that's interesting. You see, the Awareness Party has 7 principles that we believe in, and community is one of them.
Yes.
And oneness, well, it starts oneness, awareness, kindness, compassion, self-responsibility, but that all the principles work together, so not self-responsibility without kindness and compassion. And then balance, you know, looking at nature and looking at finance and those sorts of things, and community. So those are our 7 principles that we operate on. And of course, I shall be saying in a minute that this interview was sponsored by the Awareness Party. But I'm not doing an election push, because we have not got candidates for this election. So anyway, look, it's been fantastic talking to you, and we're going to have to stop now.
And we didn't even get to the environment and the rivers, but that's all part of it. But it's been wonderful talking with you. What a corridor. What a quick, it's gone so quickly to be able to exchange in this conversation. Thank you, Lisa.
It has. It's been really lovely. So thanks so much for really inconveniencing yourself to get yourself here today.
It's been a pleasure, Lisa. It's lovely. And I think these conversations will be happening all over New Zealand coming into the election, as we all, one by one, wake up. Wake up. and start researching and start questioning. Ask why.
Awesome. Thank you, Liz Gunn. You've just been listening to Green Planet on Planet FM. Join us at the same time next week, 8 a.m. Thursdays, or anytime online at greenplanetfm.com. This interview is sponsored by The Awareness Party.